their first ever Rugby World Cup. Can you share some insights and memories you have from that tournament in 1987?
You know, I know from, you know, your American viewers, you know, you got your World Series of baseball, your World this, your World that. Well, this, you know, this was a World Cup in rugby. And so, you know, it was great because you had so much support too from, you know, your friends and all that. But there's also a hell of a lot of pressure on, you know. The pressure was on to win it because it was the first, and it was the All Blacks were always, you know, that was one of their mantras that they were, you know, number one sort of thing. And so there's a lot of pressure to do that side of things as well. And you know, in the end, you know, we got it done. So we, you know, enjoyed it, and yeah, it was a great experience.
Hi, I'm Kieran Crowley, and you're listening to the Rugby Hive. Oh, did you want me to say it in Italian?
Yes, please.
Say it in Italian. Hi, I'm Nicole Crowley, and you're listening to the Rugby Hive.
And to a sculptor, Rugby Hive.
He's so dangerous, Freddy Krueger has nightmares about him.
Hello and welcome to the Rugby Hive. I'm Darren Stanford, and despite my South African accent, I was fortunate enough to play rugby for the United States on the Sevens World Series.
And I'm Robin McDougall, a former Canadian Sevens international. Back in my playing days, I went head-to-head against Dallin in the USA.
For several years, Robin has coached international Sevens for various countries, including Canada and Mexico. He's massively passionate about growing the game across the Americas through his McDougall Rugby programs at all levels. I'm currently a commentator for World Rugby, most recently broadcasting the Rugby World Cup in Japan, as well as the amazing Sevens World Series.
More than a decade later, we are teaming up to bring you insights from legendary players and coaches from around the world.
All legends have a story. The Rugby Hive podcast is here to share it.
Welcome to the Hive.
Oh, it's more dangerous than climate change.
Hello and welcome back to season 3 of the Rugby Hive. It's a happy new year to all you brilliant listeners from around the world. Hope it's been a restful festive season and you're ready to unlock a magical 2023. It's of course the year of the Rugby World Cup in France. And what a spectacle that shall be. Well, on the Hive, we feature two legends so far in Season 3. It's Episode 31 with South African Sevens captain Sheikh Sooyswapi. Episode 32, the Olympian and former USA Sevens leader Kelly Griffin. And today's episode, a blast from the past. That's right, we recorded this one back all the way when we were barnstorming in 2020. It's an age and go, but still holds up over 2 years later. Nicole Crowley and her father, Kieran. But before we get into the episode, Happy New Year, Robin. Welcome to 2023, my friend.
Happy New Year. Fired up for this year.
You're ready to rumble, my friend. You got your awesome kit on, your merch. Let's talk a bit about 2022. What was the finish like for you?
It was lovely. Got some downtime over the holidays. My wife met me in Vancouver when I flew in, and we drove straight across the Canadian prairies up over the Rockies. So I went from some plus 30 weather to minus 50 weather for a two-day trip, but had an awesome time with our family. The prairies, and got to do some outdoor hockey, and just shut down my brain for a few weeks. How about your side?
Yeah, I remember messaging you going through those terrible conditions. We actually had done the reverse. We'd left the New England weather behind us. We'd sold up our place, and Barry and I moved back to Southern California. It's kind of always the plan during the pandemic to get out of SoCal, be close to her family and things like that. But a doozy couple of months shipping across everything and getting the cars here. But well timed. We got to miss the crazy conditions there. We lasted two winters. It was brilliant being close to Boston and working with the Free Jacks, but really enjoying being back in the sunny weather and playing beach rugby here in Santa Monica, enjoying the lifestyle here in Los Angeles.
I was going to say, did you and V, while you're out there, did you get a block heater installed in your guys' Jeeps?
I have something in my Jeep where you can turn it on and you can actually start the car and start the heating process. I just never figured out how to use it, and also I didn't necessarily want to run the car for 10 minutes in this condition. So B was always upset with me, saying, you haven't started the car, it's not heated, it's freezing. So no, I didn't really learn how to do it properly. What's the block here?
Well, the Canadians, for starters, sometimes like in the middle of Canada, they won't even turn their cars off because it's too cold. They're afraid they're going to start. But a block heater, it's actually like a heating. It actually keeps your battery warm and the core, your motor warm. So you plug it in. So I bought my truck on the West Coast here, and we don't plug vehicles in because it's, you know, it doesn't get too cold. Obviously, we're never in the minus. So when I got it installed right before we went to the prairies, they were looking at me sideways like, you know, you don't need this here. It's got to be minimum minus 17 to plug it in. I'm like, well, where I'm going, I'm definitely going to need it. And day one on the trip, You know, we were at like literally minus 49 at nighttime. And if you've never been at minus, I would say 25 and below, literally running back and forth at the hotel with our puppy, like trying to get all our stuff in the room. The only thing exposed was my hands, and my hands were burning because it was so cold. Now, I'm so soft. I'm not South African as far as the cold goes, but I am a West Coaster. And man, I'm sure it makes me happy that we're back on the West Coast safe and sound. So that's what a block heater is. Fun fact.
Well, we thought we were cold in New England side, and it doesn't get anywhere close to that. So you're right. North of the border, you guys are a different breed, my friend. You're not soft at all. All right. I wanted to thank a couple of Rugby Hive partners that have joined us on this excellent journey over the last few years, and particularly heading into this new year. Those include, firstly, World Rugby Shop, makers of our apparel line, the merch we currently wearing. Just search Rugby Hive on worldrugbyshop.com. We also have our Rugby Hive branded balls, other great merch as well at gilbertrugbycanada.com. Enduro Sport, workout energy like you've never seen. You can get 40% off at rugbyhive.endurosportofficial.com. And then if you need a snack, two Biltong partners are the answer. BruceBiltong.com, available in the USA, and CanadaBiltong.com delivers in Canada, north of the border. Special thanks also to the Rugby Network showcasing our episodes on their brilliant platform. If you want to join season three as a supporter, as a sponsor, as a partner, just message us on our social at Rugby Hive. Also want to give a quick shout out to a personal friend of mine, Jeremy Castro. Worked with him at Occidental College. He was a former coach of the team. He helped me whenever we toured, printing shirts, other merch to raise money when we traveled. He also has worked in broadcasting for many years. We've done a lot of international together across national championships and many games at Infinity Park. While he's merchandise brand Marinade, going through difficult times currently. They're trying to get out of, you know, the difficulties that set them up during the pandemic. But if you can support them, they make some amazing stuff. Head to brandmarinade.com and support Jeremy Castro, the sleek sensation. All right, Robs, want to switch gears? Let's check in. Rugby items, what did you get up to close out the year since we last spoke?
Well, I got to go to New Zealand. We took the British Columbia, the regional Western Canadian U18 boys. So we selected 12 guys from 160 on our last intro for Griff. I was on my way to the final camp for that trial. Back in 2017, we started out a group of young men, and I think three quarters of them you've called on the World Series, like Lachlan Kratz, Thomas Isherwood, the Mullet Man himself, David Richards, Brock Webster, the list goes on. And that was 6 years ago now. And then obviously we had a pandemic. So this is kind of our first crop for young Canadians that'll be make their way into the Premier Sevens, MLR and World Series. We had a decent pool, Dallin. We played the Samoan Junior National Team first, then the Fijian Junior National Team, and that culminated with the Junior All Blacks. So it was a little bit of baptism by fire for our Canadian boys, most of which have only been playing rugby for a year or two on the backside of the pandemic, but that we definitely had the athleticism. It was great to get down there. Obviously, summer in New Zealand. I got to see KT play with Carlos Spencer. They had a bit of footy going on at halftime, showcasing for the kids. So there was a lot of star power there in New Zealand, and just a great experience to see these kids get a taste of what's out there for World Rugby. And then just back to the academy here, thrilled to be kicking off 2023 with our kids. They had a nice break, you know, like any centralized program. It's always good to have a break, but you know, we were about to get into things on Tuesday here. And obviously, like, I run a fairly tight ship, and I just said, you know what, you guys just catch up for 10 minutes before we get into the weight room and get moving, just because they were just so excited to share their stories and be teenagers. So that's been really rewarding, and definitely excited for what's to come. How about you?
Yeah, you're doing brilliant work there, obviously, with the academy. It's so great to see the social media coming out and been following it, obviously, from abroad. But now I want to go back to one thing you mentioned, Carlos Spencer and KT combining. How many no-look passes? How many goose steps? Give us the commentary.
I mean, like, I don't get too starstruck anymore, but when I saw Carlos Spencer, I mean, he's probably still got 4 or 5 caps in him like Quade Cooper. But yeah, it was brilliant to watch. It's just like, you know, casually walking around, you know, New Zealand, and obviously the grounds at the World Schools Games, and just, you know, it'd be like, you know, obviously for those hockey fans, it's like Wayne Gretzky, Mario Lemieux, like just like the best players of all time, just chilling, which is pretty special. And then I got to meet up with one of my original mentors, Dave Mays, who's an English gentleman, a big Hive supporter. But He lived in the Caribbean and coached a bunch there after he spent time in Canada. And so I hadn't seen him in like over a decade, but I talked to him weekly. He's gone from being like one of my, you know, my playing mentors when he was a coach. And now he's been one of my coaching mentors. So he was there coaching and, you know, I got to reconnect with him, which was magic. And then, I've just obviously everything New Zealand has to offer and, you know, rugby mad people. And then, of course, I had a couple of my academy boys, one of our graduates, Jackson Jones, that featured with the Senior Bears. He was carving young Ian Anderton Teasdale and then L. Douglas, one of my Prairie Academy kids that's moved to the coast, and they got a feature. So, again, having that opportunity to find the talent, develop the talent, and then get to see them perform and find joy was definitely a sweet spot for me.
Oh, that's so great. Yeah, also close out the year was really good to call some of those remote games. The Rugby Europe Super Cup got to the semifinals between Tel Aviv Heat and Lusa Tanush. A brilliant contest. The men from Israel advanced to the final. They just fell short to the Georgian powerhouse as the Black Line. But it was really cool to be able to call from the bedroom / kitchen, the home office. And then we were meant to connect, obviously, at the RAN, 7th in Mexico City. Both our plans got derailed for that one. 7th World Series. I definitely had FOMO when they played in Dubai and Cape Town. I was meant to do those events, but moving to California, it took up that time during that period. But then the Freetail Sevens, I got a chance to go back to Austin, Texas, do my third Freetail event, brilliantly organized by Ryan Walker and Justin Hale. We had World Rugby referee sensation, who the Gaz has featured, Kat Roche. She led the officials. Norma Salinas was our sleek sensation photographer. And the action on the field certainly delivered. Plenty of upsets in the women's division. At the death, Old Blue took out Chicago North Shore, and the men's competition, NAV Sevens, continued their unbelievable form, high-stepping their way through against Faith Rugby. $8,000 prize money up for grabs, bottles of champagne going down like a homesick mole. It was really a great way to finish off the year. And then, Rob's 2023, so much to be excited for.
Well, just going back to the Freetail Sevens, I got to tune in and hear you yell. Shout out to the NAB guys. Those guys, like, I don't know what they're feeding those guys, but they got a winning combo, those coaches in there, a couple experts. Like, those guys are just trophies on trophies. Good old CJ Jones, like, getting it done again, and a couple Canadians down there. And then I was doing some scouting for the Premier Sevens and Loonies, and there was a number of Loonies featured in there, Amanda Hall and Sativa Pihikaru, and then some other rock stars like Lindsay Mahoney from Arizona that played for the headliner. So there was a pile of talent in that tournament, and it's, you know, definitely being back in Canada where I was surrounded by snow looking at that sunshine, I'm going to have to get down to Freetail at some point.
Yeah, no, we definitely need to get you there. I mean, you are half Texan anyway with your cowboy boots and rodeo kind of skills. So we need to do that for sure. And then, Rob, tell me, what are you excited for in 2023? What's coming up?
Everything. Like, this is the year. Like, you know, all the projects have been coming together, but just more, you know, hopefully some more jars and coffees on the road with you and all my American colleagues. Taking the Loonies to another level, that's my number one focus right now outside of my academy, is building that program, lining up. I got 3 ID camps across Canada this year, looking for talent for both men and women. And I don't know if another tattoo's in the works outside of my staff that's going to be working with me, but definitely looking to go strong there this year. And we're gonna have like a preseason camp up here in the north. Been talking to Alev Kelter, Nana Favesi, try and get them up here and build it right. But it's exciting this year. Dallin, they're growing. Premier Sevens is growing from 4 franchises to 8, men and women. So they're going to have an Eastern Conference, a Western Conference. Your favorite Loonies obviously being the Western Conference. There we'll be playing in 2 stops in the West, of course, and then the 2 Eastern stops, and then the top 2 from each. So the Loonies and somebody else will be headed to Washington for the championship round to finish out the year. So that's kind of my number one focus from the professional coaching aspect. And then outside of that, you know, I got my BC Rugby junior and senior men's hat. I'm now in charge of Vancouver Island Rugby, which is obviously our region here. And just seeing where you and I can take the Hive this year as well. So just lots of exciting projects that just keep on growing, and looking forward to getting on the trail. And then another project that you're aware of, and it hasn't been launched, but it's going to be launched this spring, is my precision kicking ball that I've developed with Gilbert Global. So I'm heading to the UK in March to build the launch for that. And I think it's already in over a dozen countries around the world, kind of the soft launch. And it's going to be in hopefully every rugby nation in 12 months' time. So that's been another one of my COVID projects that's been simmering in the shadows, but now it's coming to life.
Well, that's so great. I know you can't kick for anything, but we do know a player called Ben Gollings that could strike it swiftly. Hopefully he's included in that marketing media plan.
Well, speaking of Gollings, his son, Rocco, debuted for Australia. So I got to finally meet Rocco. I might have met him in Seattle days early on, but Rocco's now playing U18 Wallabies. He's actually, I think, in Fiji right now, playing in one of the tournaments there. And so he's getting to spend some time with his dad and his younger brother and sister, which is great. But I sent a picture to Ben, and Ben, obviously being an England star working with Fiji, he goes, it's crazy seeing my son in an Australia jersey, but he looked good. And I was so excited to see Rocco play, and I only got to watch him play one game, just the way it worked out with our schedule, with our games, but he was carving. Like, everything he set up two tries, he scored the first try, set up two tries, and was just all over the field. It was just like a complete clone, and he had the dirtiest mustache, so it was class. I'm a fan.
Oh, that's brilliant. On and off the field squad goals, you know, that's so great. Carrying on the family name. That's brilliant, pal. I love everything you got planned for the new year, new goals, new opportunities for us both. I'm excited. There's a couple of new events coming up as well, which is really cool. One of them is the Super Rugby Americas. It's going to feature seven teams, one in North America, the American Raptors. There was going to be a Canadian outfit from Pacific Pride. They're not going to join yet, so hopefully it's the following year. But two teams from Argentina, one from Brazil, one from Chile, Paraguay, and Uruguay. Competition starts February 18th. I'm doing 5 of the 6 home games for the Raptors at Infinity Park. So it'll be fascinating to see how, you know, that American team does in the competition. They formerly had crossover players, so will then bring in some more rugby experience. We'll have to see how that goes. And then Major League Rugby Season 6 around the corner. For me personally, I'll only be involved in a handful of games, unfortunately, because the remote studios are based in Indianapolis on the East Coast, a bit too far. And then the other studio in Austin, they've got a few people that live close by. It will be interesting to see how those broadcasts go that side. World 7 Series, brilliant. We'll be in L.A., your neck of the woods, Vancouver. We'll hopefully meet up there. And then Hong Kong and Singapore legs in the thrilling year, which the top four sides and the men and the women will qualify for the Paris Olympics in 2024. And then you mentioned the Premier Rugby Sevens, a record number of events. Can't wait to funnel some copies and some jars with you. And as you said about the tattoo, I mean, I think you got to keep this tradition alive. Maybe it's something different. You get the city tattooed where you win. I don't know. We'll have to come up with something fun. We'll have to get your mom involved as well.
It's an initiation for all our for the other staff. Put it that way. It's part of their contract.
That's true. Or when let's say you win the Rugby World Cup, you know how they put the year on or that sort of thing. So anyway, we'll talk about that later. And then, as I said, one of my big goals is Rugby World Cup France 2023. I plan to be there, hopefully with World Rugby. If not, then celebrating the tournament with the missus and several friends. It's going to obviously be a brilliant country, a brilliant tournament. Just can't wait for that. Each year, there's always such a big pinnacle event happening every single year. And that's the great thing about the sport. All right, pal, let's preview episode 33, Nicole and Kieran Crowley. As mentioned earlier in the intro of this, of course, the content is not as current as it could be. It was filmed during the pandemic, recorded there. Kieran then was promoted after our episode, probably because he was on the Hive, promoted to coach Italy in May of 2021, caused a couple of major upsets. One of them was probably one of the bigger upsets in world rugby, defeating Australia 28-27 on the Autumn Tour, and then early in the Six Nations beating Wales 22-21. He, of course, coached with Benetton Rugby. They won the Pro 14 Rainbow Cup. They were the champions. So many great things there. I had never met Kieran before, but I've spoken to him when he was coaching Rugby Canada. And then Nicole as well comes in as a sleek sensation, who you know them both really well.
Yeah, my first impression with Kieran, like, yeah, I was playing in the Sevens team when he took over the 15s. And then after I finished playing, I was obviously right into the coaching and finding the talent, like a young Pat Kay and stuff when he was 18-19. And so I went to the Sevens camp down the road here, and I was just kind of one of the observing guest coaches. And, you know, Kieran knew I was a Sevens mad kind of guy, and that was kind of my wheelhouse. Him obviously being an All Blacks alumni, former player and world-class coach, but it was just such an interesting man and very, very intelligent and very soft-spoken. And anyway, the coach at the time, Garrett John was speaking to all these different coaches that were there. And then we were headed to walk over and watch the training session. And Kieran said to me, he goes, do you want to walk with me to the field and we'll take the long way? And I said, sounds good. And he asked me questions from the clubhouse all the way to the field, which was like a 5-10 minute walk. And I was just like, I've been coaching for 20 years, but I was obviously new to, you know, more higher performance coaches, and you got one of the classiest guys out there, but here he is asking me questions. And I'm like, that really was an eye opener for me as a coach. And when you're a young coach, you figure, you know, a lot, and here's a guy that had been around and he was asking me questions. And then halfway through the day, they're into drills and he couldn't unlock the team in some way. And he just like, hey, do you want to take over? And let me look. I don't know if he probably just wanted a break and pump my tires, but I was just like, this, just such a selfless man and open-minded and always questioned players and coaches. And then he left a really good mark and left the national team in a very good place, a lot stronger place than obviously we're at right now. And he's gone on and found success in another country over a pandemic. And obviously, as you said, won the Pro 14 Rainbow Cup and was coach of the year that year. And now is sharing his expertise with Italy, who's a rising, you know, continue rising nation. And, you know, what I love about that as well as an underdog, it's, you know, it's impossible till it's possible. Nicole, I've watched her develop as a high school player, provincial player, and into a junior national team player, and then into a university star, and then into a successful World Series Team Canada manager, and now is actually living in Tulita, Northwest Territory. So if you thought it's cold and icy where I live or where I used to live, Dallin, she is like in the Northern Shield. And her partner is a Royal Canadian Mounted Police. I believe he's from Britain. She's obviously from New Zealand originally, and she's using her expertise, organization management skills up there for a recreational community program, and very successful on and off the field. So what I really love about this episode, like we paired a number of coaches and ex-teammates and family members, is just this father-daughter combination. And you know, all she wants to talk about is her dad, and all her dad wants to do is talk about her daughter. And obviously, Kieran's younger daughter is very successful in hockey, and she's got her brother too. So just a wonderful class New Zealand family that is on the road. Kieran now is obviously in Italy. His daughter's in the Northern Hemisphere, and I'm not sure where the younger daughter was in the USA. She went to a D1, had a field hockey scholarship down there, was carving there. So very successful family all around. And yeah, I love this episode.
Oh, it's so great to hear. And I love the connection and how you got to know them as well. Make sure, listeners, you connect with our socials at Rugby Hive on Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube, at My Rugby Hive on Instagram. And of course, our website, rugbyhive.com. Please continue to be safe out there, and we appreciate all the support. It's time now for Season 3, Episode 33.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. It's a family affair today with two sleek sensations. Let's start with you, Kieran. How are you holding up in Italy, and what's life like there, and have you enjoyed the culture?
Yeah, we're holding up good. I mean, you know, it's like everyone, you know, the COVID situation is a little bit challenging for everyone. We were on we had about a 10-week lockdown period, something like that. So, which meant, you know, you had to stay in your house. You're only allowed out to the supermarket. Here in Italy, you know, we've got about same amount of people. I don't know what Canada's got, but there's about 65 million people in Italy, and it's the size of New Zealand. So, you know, there's a lot of people in small areas living in apartments. So, you know, it was a challenging time for a lot of people. You know, from a rugby perspective, you know, we got about 50-odd guys on our books, and I think there was only about a half a dozen of them that could actually had gardens where they could run in during that period. So it was a challenging time like everyone, but it's, you know, we're getting through it now and coming out the other side. But, you know, life in general in Italy, you know, it's a great country. It's a great culture. It's a great have great food, wine, et cetera, you know. So it's a real pleasure to live here.
Yeah, definitely one of tourist favorites. And Nicole, you're in a slightly different spot, a bit more of a Canadian landscape there in Yellowknife, right? Tell us about that.
I'm just up here temporarily. I'm usually based out of Victoria, but I came up here for the work from home during COVID. And it's interesting, like the winters get to negative 45 and then it's now like 19 degrees and nearly in the middle of summer. So 24 hour sunlight as well, which is super interesting. It's just a different way of life. I never thought, like, when I was growing up that I would come to Northern Canada and like go ice fishing and things like that. So it's nice.
It's a long way from New Zealand, that's for sure. Kieran, we'll start with you just diving into your younger playing days. Can you tell us how you got into rugby and what other sports you played growing up?
Yeah, I mean, New Zealand, yeah, New Zealand rugby is a national sport. So, you know, you're sort of, I was from a little country town called Kaponga. You know, we're all dairy farmers in that area. The town was a little service town, you know, only had a few hundred people with a hotel and a couple of service stores for the farming area and that. And I went to the local primary school, only 100 people, 100 kids went to it. And, you sort of start off there, you know, when you're 5 or 6 years old, just playing in the playground. And so that's where I first started because, you know, it was just rugby. Everyone played rugby or netball. Females played netball. So I started that and then, you know, just progressed from there at 5 and 6 years old to the local club. You know, they always, big thing in New Zealand as it is in Canada now, you know, Saturday morning football. And, used to run around and bare feet in the early days at 5 and 6 years old. And then, you know, I had five brothers and one sister and, you know, we used to play on the front lawn and all that. And it sort of just grew from there. So, initially started with that, but in New Zealand, I think one of the big things for sport or for rugby, if you're any good at anything, is that you try so many different sports. And, so the New Zealand thing was sort of rugby in the winter and cricket in the summer for a male. And so, you know, I played a bit of cricket as well and like it in the golf ball, that sort of stuff. But, sort of got to a stage because I was playing in the era before professionalism. So, you used to work on the farm and then go to play rugby or whatever it was. And so I sort of got to a stage where I had to choose between the rugby and the cricket. And it just happened that the rugby was on when I had to decide. So, you know, that was went that way.
Seemed to work out for you. I'd be interested to see how many All Blacks came from a farm over the years and still do.
Oh yeah. There was a lot in our time. I mean, you know, we weren't on weight programs or anything like that. There wasn't, you know, like I said, it wasn't professional rugby. You know, you used to get the rugby's changed so much now. You used to get the hard forwards that, you know, used to be working the freezing works or they used to work on the farm. You know, there just used to be a lot of provincial teams like that. But, you know, as society's changed and, the workforce has changed and that, and then, you know, rugby went professional and, so, yeah, it's changed massively. But, you know, certainly coming from a farm certainly grounded you in values and made you appreciate what you had, et cetera. So, you know, completely different to, like, the academy system and everything like that now.
And, Nicole, what sports did you get involved in growing up in New Zealand before you transitioned to Canada?
I guess, like, Dad was a head coach in rugby at the time, but he never pressured us into playing rugby. And only my brother played for a few years, but I was playing a lot of netball and a lot of basketball at the time, and I got into cricket a little bit. I wasn't very good at it, but I think we were, like, growing up, we were told to try as many sports as we could. We were always doing something. We weren't allowed to sit inside and watch TV. We were allowed maybe half an hour a night after school watching cartoons or whatever it was, but we were always at some kind of sport training, so very mediocre at a lot of different things.
That's good parenting, right? To make sure you active outside and making friends and keeping busy with, you know, your brothers and sisters. Kieran, let's switch back to your rugby playing days. Most people dream of playing international sport for their country. You obviously excelled at cricket. For our American listeners, it's like baseball, just very confusing. But to represent the All Blacks, to wear the famous New Zealand jersey, what was your pathway like to eventually getting your first international cap?
Yeah, I probably came from a different sort of pathway to a lot of people because, you know, the club I played for was Kaponga and we were only a bunch of farmers really who, you know, every little town in New Zealand had a rugby club and that was a sort of meeting point and social point. And, So, you know, we used to, you know, you never knew how many you're going to get to training because, you know, there might be things on the farm that kept guys away and that. And so, you know, we weren't a great team. We were, you know, there was, a number of divisions in the Taranaki area. We were always in the second division. But I was lucky enough to, you know, probably have a, you know, get selected for the provincial team early on because of a couple of performances, I suppose, or someone must have seen me play. But I was lucky enough for that. And then, you know, from there, you know, lucky enough to have a couple of good performances for the provincial team, which then got me into the New Zealand under 20s. So I was in that for 3 years, and then sort of progressed into the All Black side. And it was a progression that, you know, in those days, Auckland were very, very strong, and Canterbury, and so people getting in from, you know, particularly a back probably from outside those places was a little bit of a surprise, I suppose, in some respects. But I was lucky enough to get in there and then have a couple of reasonable sort of games, and sort of, you know, ended up playing for about 8 odd years for them. So I think it was about 83 to 91 or something like that. So yeah, great experience. And it's like I say, you know, it's like it's the national sport of New Zealand, so you know, there's a lot of people got a lot of opinions.
Yeah, I would imagine, you know, but a remarkable career. Let's talk about that iconic team that you were part of at the first ever Rugby World Cup. Can you share some insights and memories you have from that tournament in 1987?
Yeah, I mean, it was the first World Cup. So, you know, it was, I suppose they were testing the water a little bit. You know, it's completely different now as far as, you know, because it's growing so massively from a commercial standpoint. But, you know, the fact that it was in New Zealand, you know, in your home country, it was, you know, there was a massive buzz around it. But I remember, you know, it was just the excitement of being there, you know, and it was called a World Cup. You know, I know from, you know, your American viewers, you know, you got your World Series of baseball, your World this, your World that. Well, this, you know, this was a World Cup in rugby. And so, you know, it was great because you had so much support too from, you know, your friends and all that, but there's also a hell of a lot of pressure on, you know, the pressure was on to win it because it was the first, and it was the All Blacks were always, you know, that was one of their mantras that they were, you know, number one sort of thing. And so there's a lot of pressure to do that side of things as well. And you know, in the end, you know, we got it done. So we, you know, enjoyed it. And it was a great experience.
That's epic. Nicole, can you tell us about your rugby playing days in high school at Shawinigan Lake School and going on to represent BC as well?
Yeah, so I didn't get involved in rugby until I think grade 11. And I actually got involved. This one girl was like pestering me for years to start playing. So I finally did, and I actually really enjoyed it. So I started then, and that same year I made BC in the summer, which I wasn't planning to. And then I kept playing for them for about 4 years, I think. And then that opportunity came to go to University of Victoria and play rugby there, which was awesome. Playing at university is like completely different than high school and provincial levels. And, you know, you're training every single day. We sometimes Wednesday we'd have conditioning in the morning and training in the evening. So it was more like a, I guess, more structured environment than I was used to. And so I ended up playing there for 3 years on both their sevens and 15s team.
What were some of your highlights from your Vikes days?
Oh, I guess one of my highlights was obviously winning Canada West. So we ended up beating University of Alberta in the semifinals, and we were coming in fourth. So we got to the finals, and that took us to nationals at Queen's. So that was definitely a highlight. But also in that time when I was at UVic, I was playing with BC in the summer, and we got to win a national championship, so I got to captain the team with that. And so that was definitely a highlight, being able to do that with some of my best friends and people I was playing with university with as well.
What was your dad's support like? I know he's a humble, quiet, calculated man, but what was it like once you started playing his sport?
Yeah, he was always there on the sideline when he wasn't traveling with my mom. He always had tips for me after the game, so you know, always things I could be improving on. But he did get involved. He let the coaches that were coaching me do their thing. And then when we were at high school, actually, they asked him if they wanted to be our high school sevens coach. So he jumped at that opportunity. And, you know, going to high school provincials with a national team coach was pretty cool. We only got third, which is probably Dad's worst performance as a coach.
I think we overachieved that year.
Yeah, definitely did. So, he's always been there. You know, both my parents been always supportive of mine and my siblings. Sport goals, whatever they have been. Like, I just eventually chose rugby, but my sister's a national level field hockey player back in New Zealand. And so they've always go out of their way to support us in whatever those goals are. So, yeah, it's been awesome.
That's wonderful. Must have been very proud for you, Kieran, as a dad, watching your daughter play.
Oh, yeah, we are proud of all the kids, you know, as long as they are happy in what they're doing and, you know, they're doing something like that, it's great. So, you know, all three have been, we've been very lucky in that they've all chosen to get involved in things like that. And, you know, I think team sport and even individual sports, you know, they teach a lot of discipline and a great character building.
Moving on to your coaching story. So what was your transition like from being an All Black and playing over 200 games for Taranaki to becoming a coach? And what were some of your coaching influences as you made that transition in those early days?
Yeah, I went from when I first retired. I mean, I was still, you know, I played for our local club team for so long and obviously having a bit of experience away with national teams and that, you know, I was sort of helping coach as I was playing. But when I decided it was enough, I knew being in the club I was in that if I stayed in there for the next year, I was going to get dragged back into playing because, you know, they'd be short and, you know, they'd say, I'll bring your boots and all that. And so I sort of stayed away from it for a year, you know, made a complete break and then, which was probably the best thing I did. You know, I still supported them a little bit, but, you know, just didn't get involved in the playing coaching side of things. But then I went back to... went back and coached him for a couple of years, but then got asked to do what we called the Taranaki B side, which would be like the provincial B side. Did those for a couple of games, and then got asked to help out with the provincial side, the Taranaki provincial side, as an assistant coach. And that was sort of coincided with the time that rugby went professional. So the head Taranaki coach at that time was helping out with the Hurricanes. So they said to me that I needed to go full-time and I would need to shift off the farm at that time. So we decided to take the jump and so I went full-time and moved house to New Plymouth, which was about an hour away from where we actually lived, which was the base for the Taranaki province. And so I had 4 years as an assistant coach with him, I think it was, and then 5 years, 5 years as the Taranaki head coach. And then I was lucky enough to get selected to coach the New Zealand under-19s for a couple of years. So we went to a couple of World Cups. We got second in a tournament in Dubai. We were in the World Cup in Dubai, and we won the World Cup in Ireland with the under-20s. But, you know, it's funny how you look at things as coaching because I believe that what we achieved with a team that got second as coaches was a hell of a lot more than what we achieved with the team that won it because, you know, the team that won it had guys like Sam Whitelock and Crotty and, you know, all those guys that are All Blacks now, whereas the team the year before had very few All Blacks in it. And, you know, so I thought we achieved a lot more with the team that got second than the team that got first. So it's just interesting how sometimes, you know, players make coaches, I suppose. So I did that, and that was how I transitioned into the coaching side of things.
And then you got an opportunity in 2008. You moved your family across to Vancouver Island, take over the Canadian men's program. How did that opportunity come about, and was it challenging to move your whole family across, you know, your kids, Nicole, Casey, and Jaden?
Yeah, I mean, it was... I got to where I got to in New Zealand and, you know, a new CEO came into the Taranaki province and, you know, it was time for me to move on, really. You know, you can't stay somewhere forever. And I applied for one of the Super Rugby jobs and I got down to the last two. And the feedback I got was that I hadn't been outside my comfort zone. You know, I'd been in Taranaki and, you know, I hadn't really... I suppose, explored other teams or other cultures, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, sitting there thinking, oh, well, what the hell am I going to do then? I might have to go back to the farm. But then, you know, we looked at things and, you know, there's a couple of jobs that were were available at the time. There was the American national coach, so I applied for that, as well as the Canadian coaching job, and never ever heard back from the American guys, but the Canadian guys, they you know, replied and flew over and had an interview, and we went from there. And yeah, it's a big move. You know, the kids were, I think they were 10, 12 and 14 at the time, I think it was. So it was a big move for them, you know, and with Sue as well. But, you know, I found, you know, kids adapt pretty quickly. Yes, they've got friends that they leave, but then they, you know, get into schools or get into sports teams and make friends again pretty, you know, pretty quickly. And then that also, you know, gets, as parents, you know, you get involved with parents of other kids and who, you know, they are involved with sort of thing. So the transition was, you know, probably a lot smoother than what a lot of people would think that the transitions are. But because we were going to an English-speaking country too, it's completely different if you go to a foreign-speaking country. So it was, no, it was fine. I mean, you know, they're still, you know, home's always home, isn't it? And, you know, but now, you know, Nicole and the others, you know, they've lived in Canada longer than they have in New Zealand now. So it's Canadian citizenship and passports and all that. So, you know, they, you know, I don't know where Nicole calls home now.
Yeah, Nicole, we're going to get, exactly, we'll get to your accent in a bit as well. What was it like for you as a young teenager to move to North America? I mean, accent-wise, I struggle to understand Robin every day, and I've known him for years, you know, so.
Yeah, well, one thing that Dad, like, missed out of that story is that we as kids actually drove a pretty hard bargain to move across to Canada. So we said when he was coming over for his interview that if he got the job, we would only move if we got to go to Disneyland. Like, that was our... that was our thing. So when he eventually told us that we were going to be moving to Canada, the first thing that he said was, well, I guess we're going to Disneyland. And then, so that was something that actually eased our transition because we stopped at LA on the way. So we were all looking forward, like, it was sad leaving, but we were all looking forward to Disneyland because that was kind of our goal out of the whole thing. but yeah, now it's totally different. Like, I love it here. Like, all my friends through high school and university are all here. I still maintain a lot of relationships with my friends back in New Zealand. And when I'm lucky enough to go back and visit, we try to catch up with some of them. The hardest part is leaving all your family and your cousins. Like, we, both my mom and my dad's side, we have really close-knit families and you know, used to have, like, Sunday lunches together after church or Christmas and everything. And so the biggest part for me was leaving the family and leaving that kind of connection you have. And now with my parents in Italy, my sister's back in New Zealand and my brother's in Ontario. So I'm kind of a one woman army out here. And so sometimes, you know, you do get homesick. So yeah, that's probably the biggest thing. But the move in general was like Dad said, it was super seamless around like getting involved in sports, like getting involved in things and having Mum and Dad there to meet parents and, you know, see the next opportunity and the next opportunity. And I think without the move, I struggle to see where I would be these days. Like, the opportunities that it's opened up for us in terms of university and work opportunities has been huge. And so we've got to experience a lot more of the world by just coming here. Like, when I was growing up, I would have never thought I would be in Northern Canada, you know, where it's negative 45 half the year. So yeah, it's been awesome.
Well, you're a true Canadian now. You got street credit after going up north for sure. One of my first, the first time I actually connected with you, Kieran, was it was after my playing days. I was just doing a bit of guest coaching at a sevens camp that you were involved in and kind of overseeing. And I'll never forget it. And you probably don't remember it, but we were just in the Derek Hiley Pavilion at Shawnigan, and we were walking up to one of the newer fields, and you just pulled me aside and said, "Do you want to walk with me?" And we went and we took the long way. It took about 15 minutes, nice and slow. But I just thought, like, this guy is completely class. And you asked me questions just about the whole time. And, you know, we've had a lot of foreign coaches that have come over, but not all of them actually ask questions and ticked a couple boxes with the locals. And that just, that approach, not only, you know, not only did I appreciate it, but it definitely impacted me as a coach, as a Canadian coach, but also a coach that's now worked in other countries. So, that just says a lot about your character. Can you, just going back to your early days when you took over that men's program,
What was it like with the program when you took it over, and what kind of things did you put in place on and off the field to try and move it forward?
When I first, because I went over first before before the family shifted, so I had about a month or so there, I think, and then I went back to New Zealand and we come back together. But when I first got there, then they decided to send me around the country to visit all the provinces. So that was a bit of a whirlwind. And then also there was a game over in St. John's. And they said, oh, you go over and see that game in St. John's. And there's a couple of players, we think you should be looking at. So it took me all bloody day to get there. Rained like hell. Two guys I went to watch never touched the ball. And I flew home again. I left on Friday morning, got home Monday morning. And, that was a real eye-opener for me, just the size of the country. I knew it was a big country, but just, the breadth of it.
So, I think it's perspective-wise for listeners, it's about six time zones to get there.
Yeah, it was. And, I mean, it was a five-hour flight and then a transition and then a four-hour flight. It was, it's a long trip, same as going across the US or whatever. But so that was a bit of an eye-opener. I found it very parochial, very province parochial, and there was always, there was a fierce rivalry, between provinces, there was the Ontario side, there was the BC side, there was that. So that was always a challenge, My philosophy around, international coaching, because we were responsible for the international side of it. And I mean, the big challenge is that there was no professional competition. So there was no professional teams that players were getting their education from, I suppose. With that, what I tried to implement or what we tried to implement was, a transition through the provinces that, there was provincial links to a little bit like the New Zealand system, really, that the provincial link pushed to the, pushed to the provincial link, which then, pushed to the national team. But it was, a challenging situation. One, like I say, because of the size of the country and also because of the, you have different levels of competition and that side of things. There's some damn good players in Canada. It's just they need to get into those environments where they are getting the day-to-day training, if they want to compete on the international scene. If you don't want to compete on the international scene, well, everything's great. You just carry on doing what you're doing. But, if you want your top players to be representing your country and that, you need to have some systems in place that develop them and be able to do that. So, we tried to do that, I would have to say it wasn't as successful as I would have liked it to have been, that side of things, because you're always playing the political battle, you're always playing, other people are playing even club battle in some cases. So that was a challenge, but we tried and, we gave it our best shot and, we had some success and we obviously had some failures as well. But, I can sit here and say that we gave it our best shot.
Well, if you win every game, you don't learn much. And I know from some of the sides I've worked with that, at the time is very frustrating. And again, working with a national team, there's a lot of working parts and there's a lot of, you don't have access to the players like you do in a professional side as well, full time. So obviously you must have gained a great deal from those challenges, from those opportunities that have now set you up for success. So what were some of the biggest learnings you took out of your two World Cups with Canada, your experience running this country? And then, how did that help shape you for your next opportunity?
Oh, I think you're learning all the time, like you say. I mean, you learn, and if you think you know everything, you might as well give up anyway. So, the New Zealand World Cup was outstanding, from a coaching perspective, because I was going home to home country sort of thing. I knew the lay of the land. So, as far as organisation goes, I was able to get a pretty good program together when we were over there, in the pre-program, we went to Australia. So I think, we had a great team spirit, I think, in that tournament, and we played some reasonable rugby. We won one game, and then I think it was Tonga we beat, and then we drew against Japan, I think it was. And then all France had to do was beat Tonga for us to automatically qualify for the next World Cup. But of course, you know, being the French, they decided to lose to Tonga, so that was a big downer for us. But yeah, no, that you know, that tournament was great. And then the went to the World Cup in 2015, I think it was, in England. And, you know, I thought we played really good rugby there, and we just didn't get the results we, well, you know, you always think you deserve better, but, you know, we just didn't get it. I mean, we had Italy shot to pieces, I thought, but it came back to in the end. I think, you know, we weren't exposed to that level of rugby for 80 minutes. You know, we last 70-odd minutes we were in the game, and then the last 10 they got over top of us. And then, you know, the Romania game, which we were leading quite easily, and there's probably, you know, a couple of things just didn't quite go our way, and in the end they tipped us over as well. So we went home with no points, you know, tail between the legs a little bit. But I thought we played some pretty good rugby because we performed pretty well against Ireland as well, and I think France was the other team that year, I'm not sure. But anyway, so, you know, you learn from that. You learn not to take everything for granted. It's different because it's interesting too, you know, how you've got to adapt to things. Like when I was in Canada, I had an interview for the Blues job, Super Rugby job in New Zealand. John Kerwin got the job. There was him and me and Pat Lamb, who's now coaching at Bristol. We were in the final three. Pat was a coach, but they asked him to reapply. But so I had the interview by Skype, and they were asking about my leadership philosophy and, you know, how I do things from a leadership with the Canadian side. And what they didn't realise was the challenges that, you know, you can't fly all your leadership guys in from all over the country. You know, you haven't got a budget to do that, so you've got to do things differently. And you know, so you learn how to adapt to the situation you're in. But in New Zealand, they couldn't understand it. You know, they couldn't understand that you didn't have the money to do this, or you didn't, you know, didn't do it this way sort of thing. So I think when you're coaching in a tier two country as Canada is, you know, you've got to learn to make the most of what you've got and get the best out of what you've got. And you know, all the players and management and all that, and you know, they were great. They, you know, they give it 100%, and you know, there's some, you know, good coaches and that, and they're all working to help Canada be better. So you've got to make the most of the resources you have.
Yeah, certainly it's a tricky one. I know from being in the US as well, limited resources, and it is tough to compete as a developing nation as well. But let's talk golf for a moment, and it's not something we often say on this podcast. But Nicole, I believe you work with Golf Canada. Can you give us some of your learnings being involved with that sport and organization?
Yeah, so I had a brief stint at Golf Canada for just under a year. I was hired in the professional championships department. So my role was to work closely with the PGA Tour and the LPGA Tour. And we put on the RBC Canadian Open, which is a PGA event, and then the CP Women's Open, which is the LPGA event. And it was very different. Like going, I guess, from working in team sports to working in individual sports was very different in how you interact with the players and the people. And also the money, like being in North America and rugby, there's not as much money. But going to, you know, the prize purse of the RBC Canadian Open, the winner gets over $1 million. And so the like standard of care you need to give the athletes, their requests are, you know, over the top. Like everyone who makes the tournament gets to drive around in a BMW for the week. And, you know, they're staying at the nicest hotels. And so I think it was very, very different for me and very eye-opening. Definitely learned a lot from around like professionalism and athlete care. Just being able to, I guess, have the highest standard for people. And I think that's something that like is really, well, I guess it's like when you're doing a bunch of different sports as a kid and you learn a lot of different skills. And then when you go into the working environment and you're working in sport, being exposed to different sports, like my experience with rugby in a managerial role to be an event side in tournament services with LPGA and PGA players, it kind of just expands your horizon. And I think, you know, there's different learnings you take away from each thing. Like, I guess when we were with golf, you know, there's the risk of like, well, thunder and lightning, same with rugby, but these people are carrying around metal clubs. So, you know, you have to be a lot more vigilant around that kind of stuff. And I think just like being exposed to bigger tournaments and, you know, now working on the World Series, that huge tournaments, but working with the professional championships in golf, you know, we were selling buildings there for $100,000 for people to sit in for the day or for the week. And it was just a totally eye-opening to see how high class, I guess, the golf world can be. And then coming back to rugby, where it's a lot more humble and people a lot more, I guess, ground workers, and, you know, there's a lot more volunteers and things like that. So it was definitely an interesting experience, and I enjoyed my time in the organization a lot. Like, the people, they were super friendly, and, you know, they had cool work programs. Like, they had a little driving range and putting green in the office. So, you know, on people's breaks, they would go down and hit some balls and stuff, which was super neat. So, yeah, it was definitely a great experience.
Well, it's a good thing they had a one-woman army working there, you know?
Yeah.
And let's transition back. So you were working with the 15s women as a manager before that opportunity. And then how did you transition back into the women's program for rugby, and how did the Olympic team manager come about?
Yeah, so I started at Rugby Canada as an intern. So a lot of people don't know, but the interns at Rugby Canada got paid $1,500 for 4 months' work. So that was one of my summer jobs going into university. And I more just took it for the experience that came with it. You know, I've always had a passion for the sport with my dad being so involved. And so my job was more women's program support. And then what happened is they couldn't get a women's 15s manager for one of the tours. So I was 18 at the time. And since I was an intern, it was my turn to go. So I was started managing that program at 18, which was a little bit scary, you know, being the youngest person on tour and being the one in charge, more or less. So that was my first experience. And so I was doing the work with the women's 15s on like a contractual basis while I was in business school at UVic. And so I would go and tour, I would do the work on the side, and it definitely wasn't a full-time gig. And so we were gearing up for the 2017 World Cup, and so that was kind of the pinnacle of what I was working towards for that. And that was in Ireland, and that was obviously not as successful as we would have hoped. We finished fifth, you know, we had a rough pool game versus Wales, and yeah, it didn't make us into the semis. So that was super disheartening, but, you know, coming away with your last game as a win is always a plus. And then after that, I decided to go very left field, and I went on exchange actually to Thailand for 4 months. So I kind of just picked everything up, and I went over there to do a semester of university, kind of just to get away, do something on my own, you know, like not have as much support. And that was definitely a huge learning experience for me. And so then while I was there, that's when I got my Golf Canada gig and tried that experience. But they had another women's manager in the sevens role, and it just wasn't quite working out. So they reached back out to me to apply, and I did, and went through the interview process. And yeah, and then I was back in BC in September 2018 and been working on the World Series with that Olympic team since. And, you know, it's been a lot of learning. There's been a lot of up and downs, and there's a lot of differences between sevens and 15s. You know, like with the sevens program, we have the full-time structure. We have the full-time athletes that you're taking care of day in, day out, and then you're touring nearly once a month. So, you know, being away from home for 2 weeks and coming home for three and then leaving to another time zone for two, it takes a toll on you, but it's really rewarding work. And the countries and places you get to see are amazing. Like, I never thought I would go to South Africa or Dubai or places like that. Like, working on the World Series, yeah, that's definitely a like plus of the job. You get to, you know, experience all these things. You know, the days, people think as a manager that it's not a ton of work all the time, but the days are long. You're always the first one up and last one to bed. You know, I remember this year we had an athlete who broke her nose in the Dubai game, in the Dubai final, and we were flying to South Africa the next day, and I didn't get home from the hospital until 2 a.m. and we were up at 4, and I still had to pack all the bags. So it's really long days and hard work, but it's really rewarding and feeling like you're part of the team and part of the success.
Well, you're doing a great job. I tell you what, as a international coach, you live and die by your manager, having a great manager. And I went on tour with the U18 boys team, the Youth Commonwealth Games, Lee Douglas and I. And Lee was the assistant coach for the men's team. And we didn't have a manager. Well, Lee's never been more lost in his life. So I had assumed the manager role. I had some late nights at the hospital. And yeah, we definitely appreciate all the work you do. Let's switch back over to you, Kieran. So you made another fine choice in your country selections, Canada, and then you moved over to Italy. Just a quick question, because I spent the season there in Ferrara, Italy, when I was a younger man. And the number one word that every time I ask when things are going to happen, and I got to put in context, I'm half Italian. My mother was born there. So I'm very much Italian, but the number one thing they always said when I said, when's this happening? When's that happening? When do I get to start school? When do I start this? Or everything was domani. So every day I'd walk into the office and I would say, do not start my day with tomorrow. Cause if you start my day tomorrow, then we're in trouble. And they're just like, just have an espresso and sit down. So what's life like in Italy, and how was that transition to Treviso in 2017?
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, yeah, the you know, Italian lifestyle is pretty relaxed. You know, domani meaning tomorrow, and you know, it'll happen. You know, it will eventually happen. It just might not happen exactly when you want it to happen, but it will happen. And so, you know, they're very family orientated people, the Italians. You know, everything involves around the meal, around the kitchen table. You know, that's why they have the long lunches, etc. You know, that's the time they catch up. That's the time they talk. Very social. So, yeah, no, the transition's been great. I mean, yeah, I've been with Canada for 8-odd years, I think it was, and I got asked to apply for a job in the Pro 14, and, you know, went through the process and, yeah, got the job. And Treviso, when I come here, they were they used to be one of the champion clubs in Italy when they played in the Italian championship, you know, but when they went to the, it's been called a number of names, but it's now, you know, the Guinness Pro 14. You know, they haven't been that successful in it. You know, they had a couple of years earlier on where they're sort of mid-table, but 3 years before I arrived, you know, they were bottom in two of those years and second to bottom in the other year. So the sporting director was a guy who had finished playing. You know, he'd got the job and he was a Treviso man through and through. And he said to me when they gave me the position, he said he wanted to see a change in the culture, a change in the way they played, because they were a very forward orientated team. A change in the culture, you know, coincided with a change in work ethic, etc. You know, change in the values of the team, and that was showing. So he wanted to see that. He said, you know, he was pretty open about things. He said, you know, the first year I just want to see a little change. The second year, you know, can we, you know, win a few games to get towards the middle of the table. Third year, middle of the table. Fourth year, you know, if possible, you know, we'd like to get to the playoffs, which, you know, is top eight sort of thing. But so he didn't have goals that were, you know, out of the realm of possibility. So, different, hell of a lot different than Canada, because, you know, you've got a full-time, you know, 5 or 7 days a week. Our weekly schedule, you know, starts Monday morning, you know, it's at 7 o'clock, and, you know, you have full days. So, you know, you've got our staff set up as we have 5 coaches, we have 3 full-time physios, we have 3 full-time S&C guys, we have 2 analysis guys, then you have your manager and your administration around that. We have 51 players, I think it is, on the books at the moment. You know, and we need those because, you know, we generally have about 20-odd are away with the Italian national team. So, you know, and then you add your injuries to that. And the season is so long. I mean, you know, your season's, you know, you play 30-odd games a year. So you've got to have a lot of numbers. So, yeah, completely different. From that perspective, different than the fact that, you know, we fly every second week. We fly either to England, to Wales, Ireland, Scotland, or even South Africa to play games. So, you know, there's a lot of travel involved. So the management of the whole situation of the whole club is completely different than what it is in Canada. And it's, yes, it is a sport, but it's also a business. So, you know, you have those challenges that you have to deal with as well. So, but, you know, it's been great here. I mean, you know, I've got a really good coaching team when I first come in. One of my realms was also, you know, I had to develop the coaches. And so I had a South African guy who had been playing here in Italy for 15 years and had helped coach the last couple of years in Treviso. So he was in the coaching staff, but then the other three coaches were all first-year coaches. So, you know, that was a learning curve for them too, because, you know, as a coach, young coach coming through, you think you know everything, and you think you're going to make all the difference in the world, and then, you know, you get two games in and you lost both of them and you're looking sideways, what the hell am I doing wrong? You know, so it was an interesting thing, you know, also, you know, managing the expectations of those sort of those guys. And And, you know, they're all damn good coaches. You know, they'll carry on. You know, obviously when I go, they'll still be around. So, yeah, it's been really interesting, very rewarding. You know, as, you know, like Nicole was saying before, around these sort of things, you know, if you're planning things and things, you know, you get benefits from it, or you see benefits from it, you know, you're, it's rewarding. And, you know, we've had three really good years here. This last year, obviously, was has been curtailed a little bit, and you know, we're here for another year at least, so we're looking forward to that.
Well, if it's one thing we learned on this podcast, it's that the Crowley family is not afraid to put the work in and put long hours and get it done, you know. But let's talk about that last season, 2019. You were a recipient of the Guinness Pro 14 Coach of the Year recognition, Benetton Treviso. That season, first Italian side to reach the knockout stages. What exactly do you attribute that success? Because we've got a lot of coaches that are listening, and, you know, what sort of things did you add to that side to get them to that that area?
I think one of the first things you do when you have to go, you know, when you go in somewhere, it was the same in Canada. You know, you've got to immerse yourself in the culture. You've got to understand the people. You know, I think one of the big things. It was a little bit the same I felt when, you know, I got to Canada as it was when I came here to Italy, is that, you know, players did what they were told, you know, in the game. You know, coaches were very prescriptive. Players never really had ownership of anything. So, you know, we tried to give them more ownership of things. We also developed their skills. You know, we spent a lot of time the first couple of years just on skills, you know, catch and pass. I mean, you know, their forwards and even some of their backs used to get scared in open spaces. You know, they didn't know what to do, you know, and so they'd look for the contact. So we used done a lot of that. And, you know, that year, you know, I think we were the most offloading team in the competition, or second to most offloading team in the competition. I think we had some really good foreign boys as well. You know, we have couple of players from South Africa, a couple from New Zealand. Not your real top players, but, you know, you can't get your, you know, sometimes your top players wouldn't suit the teams they go to. You know, you've got to have players that suit the environments they go to. So we're very fortunate in that. And, you know, we've developed a spirit in the club, I suppose, which, you know, we wanted to build a winning culture was what they wanted to do. And it was interesting, you know, because I come from a background that, you know, you got to win, you know, you want to win the tournament. But then, you know, when we're doing our pre-season goals 2 years or 3 years ago, you know, some guys said, you know, we want to win the tournament. And then some guys piped up and said, well, I don't think we can. You know, and if they don't think you can win it, well, you're never going to win it. So, you know, you have to readjust your goals. And now I think we're at a stage where they think they can win it. So, you know, that is a progression. Now, whether we ever well or not is in the lap of the gods, but, you know, we'll work hard and see where we get to.
Yeah, as Robin says, dream, believe, succeed. So appreciate that insight. That's extremely valuable, you know. Nicole, let's switch across to yourself. Big year coming up, of course, Tokyo Olympics moved across to 2021. How are the staff at Team Canada approaching the return to train?
Yeah, so we're in the process right now looking at how we can get the team back into the full-time training environment. So the athletes have had about 3 months off now. Well, off. They're training from home, not in a centralized spot due to COVID, but we're working on getting them back now. This past week, the athletes that are based in Victoria just able to start lifting weights again at the training center under supervision of strength and conditioning coaches. That's huge. But the staff in general, we have 11 staff with the women's national team preparing for the Olympics. And you know, we're lucky that, well, we were on a great track last year. You know, we finished second and third in tournaments leading into what was going to be the Olympics. But now we're lucky we get a second go at it. So all those mistakes we've made along the way, you know, no tour is perfect. No game's perfect. There's always learnings for both staff and the players. And we get a second crack at it. So that's kind of what we're looking at the feedback from the tournaments last year, looking at where we can, you know, put more resources in order to help the team perform the best, or, you know, adjust training accordingly. So the biggest unknown for us is, and planning wise, is we don't know when the competitions are going to be. You know, World Rugby has some outlined right now, but whether those go ahead, we have to just wait and see. But yeah, it's, I guess, just keeping on the same page. We actually have a staff meeting today to discuss more about that. But it's hard to plan with so many unknowns. So, you know, being adaptable, staff and athletes, has been a huge learning for us right now.
Just another day on the World Series. Don't know what's going to happen in 5 minutes. What will it mean for you to be part of Team Canada at the Olympics next year, Nicole?
Yeah, so I got my first experience at a major game as part of Team Canada down in Peru at the Pan Am Games this past year. And, you know, having all the other sports around you is so different than being on the World Series. You know, your World Series, you share passion with everyone else. You all love the same sport, but when you're in a multi-sport game environment, you can learn so much from other athletes, from other staff. You know, you grow your network. You have different people motivating you in different ways. The culture of Team Canada as a whole is super exciting. You know, like, they're very team orientated. I remember we were in the gold medal game at Pan Am's, and you know, you had the field hockey team there. You had your baseball team there, you had every team there trying to support you to win gold. And I think that kind of culture from Team Canada as a whole is huge. And, you know, as a kid playing sport, you know, you love it when 4 years come around and the Olympic Games are on, and you love the idea of, like, oh, one day maybe I'm going to be an Olympian. But that obviously doesn't happen to many of us. So it's awesome to be able to be a part of the team in a different aspect and helping, you know, those athletes that do exceed and in the top 1% of people in their craft, and help them win gold. So, yeah, I'm super excited and looking forward to the opportunity.
Well, I'm looking forward to watching Canada get on the podium again. I know it's going to happen. And thanks. Thank you for all you do for our sport. Kieran, I'll transition back to you. Final thoughts here. But is there any possibility that you and your wife will be attending to watch your daughter be involved in that event next year?
Well, you never know, like you say. You know, you never know what happens. You know, it would be great if the opportunity come, we certainly, you know, would certainly jump at her. You just don't know how the cards fall.
You must be a proud father.
Oh yeah, you know, we watch all the tournaments. You know, we stream them, so we watch the Canadian women's games, and you know, always. You know, see what Nicole's doing, and you know, support her in that way. You know, it's great. It's we really enjoy it.
Well, she's lucky to have a mentor like you as well. Just last thought for all those aspiring coaches out there. Just what would be some words of advice you would share? Because I know in Canada, for myself, I've had a Badger gentleman like you for a long time. So that's kind of one of the ideas of the podcast, is to try and share this valuable information. What would you pass on to Rugby Hive listeners?
Oh, I think, you know, as a coach and as a player, you know, you're always learning. You know, you're always I'm a better coach this week than I was 2 weeks ago. You know, you have different experiences all the time, and you have to you know, you learn from them. You're going to make mistakes. You know, you do make mistakes, but it's just about learning from those, and you know, nothing's free either. You know, you've got to work hard at it. You know, I think I just said last week that our players had a week off because we'd done a 6-week block after we were out of lockdown. So we'd done 6 weeks of training. So they had a week off, but I had all the staff, and we had a 3 or 4 day workshop where we looked at how we work and all that sort of stuff. And it was, you know, you learn from those sort of situations. You learn talking to other coaches, you know, just listening to them. There's been some great podcasts on. you know, over this whole lockdown situation or, you know, COVID situation. So you're always learning and you're always, you know, going to be better. And sometimes things won't work out the way you want them to work out, but you just got to keep at it. And, you know, I think that's a thing that, you know, young coaches need to understand. You know, and your style changes. You've got to find out your style and what your philosophy is. You know, I mean, when I first started coaching, no one knew about the questioning way to coach, or, you know, everyone just told everyone what to do, and, you know, players accepted that. But you change as you get experience, I suppose, and you just go and you got to enjoy it, because if you're not enjoying it, you might as well give up and go and do something else.
Well, it's such an honour to have an All Black and Rugby World Cup winning sensation, plus a future Olympic team manager, all from the same family. With 5 Rugby World Cups between the two of you, the Rugby Hive thanks you.
Yeah, thanks very much, guys. We appreciate certainly the invite to be on. It's been really enjoyable, and all the best to you.
Okay, awesome. Thank you, guys.
All right, thanks, guys. Cheers. Thank you very much.
All the best, Kieran. Bye, Nicole.
Also never stops talking, does Petronato, but I suppose that's the job of a scrum off.
Set!
He feeds. 5 out from the own line. Satutu picks up, finds Jordan. Jordan skins one. Back to Hoskins Satutu. Here comes Petronato. Back of the inside. Barrett! Oh, not even Wes Craven could have directed that. It's frightening from the All Blacks. And Bowden Barrett gets a popular try in DC.
Thank you for listening, you sleek sensations.
If you haven't already, please subscribe to Rugby Hive Podcast and catch us on all the socials at Rugby Hive.
We appreciate your support. Be safe out there, and we'll see you soon.